Okay, everyone's familiar with the concept of Chalav Yisrael, that milk that is supervised by a Jew is considered to be Chalav Yisrael, and the Mishnah Maseches Avodah Zarah says that we're supposed to drink only Chalav Yisrael. It's the Mishnah in Lamites Amud Beis in Maseches Avodah Zarah. And the Mishnah on Lamed Hey Amid Beis says that if it's a milk which is not supervised in the milking process by a Jewish person, so then that's one of the items that Chazal prohibited. And the reason why they prohibited it was because of a fear that if there's a Gentile farmer who's doing the milking, so maybe they'll mix the kosher milk together with non-kosher milk. What could be non-kosher about milk? Well, if the milk comes from a non-kosher animal, so then that's considered to be not kosher, because we have a principle of Yotzei Min HaTameh Tameh, that if I have some type of emission from a non-kosher animal, so then that emission, what comes out, is also considered to be non-kosher. The Gemara has a discussion of exactly how we derive that. The Gemara in Bechorah, Staf of Amud Beis, quotes Rabbi Shimon, who learns it from Es HaGamal. Es, the word Es, means that not only is the Gamal, the camel, prohibited, but the Es, what comes out of the gumal, what comes out of a camel, is prohibited. The milk that comes out of a camel is prohibited. Some will learn it from the fact that we have the prohibition of against eating a camel recorded twice in the Torah, right? Once in Vayikra, and once in Sefer Vayikra, once in Sefer Devarim, so that we have a source that the camel milk or other milk from non-kosher animals would be prohibited. So that's what we're worried about. We're worried about the admixture of the kosher milk with the non-kosher milk. So everybody who goes into the stores today, you shop in the supermarket, and you see that there are different types of kosher milk that's sold in the aisles. There's the kosher milk that says Chalav Yisrael, that this is the milk that has been supervised by a Jew. People may not know what Chalav Yisrael means. Chalav Yisrael comes from the Lashon of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Ve'elu mutarim ba'achila chalav shechava or kochavim yisrael oeyu." This is what's permitted to be consumed, milk which is milked by a Gentile farmer, and a Yisrael sees it. So you have the beginning of the sentence is chalav, and then the end of the sentence is yisrael oeyu, that a Jew sees it. Sometimes you might think that Yisrael means it's owned by a Jew, it's manufactured by a Jew. It doesn't mean any of those things. Chalav Yisrael is shorthand for chalav, milk that is milked by a Gentile farmer, be Yisrael, and a Jew sees it. That's what Chalav Yisrael means. It means a milk which is milked, it can be milked by somebody else, and the Jew sees the process. He sees the milking process. That's what's considered to be Chalav Yisrael. So you have milk products that say Chalav Yisrael, very nice, but then you have other milk products that have a reliable kosher certification, have hashgacha on them, but they don't say Chalav Yisrael. They'll just say OU or OUD. So that's not Chalav Yisrael. So how is it that we allow milk to have a kosher? It's scandalous. We allow milk to have, I mean that facetiously. We allow milk to have a kosher certification, even though it's not Chalav Yisrael. And the Mishnayos, the Maseches Avodah Zarah, say that the Chazal decreed that you can't drink milk unless it is Chalav Yisrael. So there are various heterim that have been given as to why we would allow this type of milk that is not Chalav Yisrael, because what essentially the rabbinic authorities over the centuries concluded is that there are three types of milk. There's Chalav Yisrael, there's the milk that's supervised by a Jew, and it's Chalav Akum, and there's the milk that was prohibited by Chazal. Chazal said you can't have Chalav Akum milk, but we're worried that there's a mixture of the kosher milk, like cow milk, together with the non-kosher milk, together with, camel milk, and because the mixture would make it indiscernible that there's some camel milk which is inside. And then there's Chalav Stam, meaning milk which is not Chalav Yisrael, but it's not so bad as Chalav Akum, because we're not reasonably worried that there would be any kind of admixture of non-kosher milk together with the kosher milk. None of this means that anybody would allow there to be a process where there's no type of supervision when you give a hashgacha, when you give a kosher certification upon a product, whatever kosher supervision exists with other products to make sure that the ingredients that are used with respect to vitamins that are put in are not going to be problematic and so forth. But that's different from requiring supervision at the milking site itself. So that's what Chazal said. Chazal said, in addition to whatever other criteria you're going to have to provide certification, you're going to require actual supervision, an actual Jewish person presence at the milking site itself in order for milk to be considered to be kosher. So what I'd like to discuss today are some of the considerations that have been utilized by the poskim throughout the centuries in terms of finding possible leniencies for milk where there is not active supervision of the milking process by a Jew, and how those leniencies may be challenged or may need to be revisited in the modern age based on changes on the ground. And the most interesting change on the ground in the last couple of years has been the introduction of camel milk into the market here in the United States. Up until several years ago, it was a felony to manufacture and to sell camel milk in the United States. It was felt, you know, that's not real milk. It's not real healthy milk. You know, you're going to talk about feeding, you know, milk to a child and so forth. So you want it to be genuine, healthy cow milks, you know, according to, you know, the traditional definition of milk. And camel milk was completely prohibited. But several years ago, there was a crusader in favor of camel milk by the name of Dr. Millie Hinkle. She's somebody with a degree who lives in North Carolina, and she began to promote all of the alleged health benefits of camel milk, that apparently camel milk can be good for curing cancer, for defeating autism, and for really solving all of the world's problems. So she started a company called Camel Milk USA. You can go on the internet and you can see these beautiful, idyllic, you know, pictures of just these open pastures and grass and trees and sprawling hills and just a wonderful embrace of nature. And part of this utopian scene is that if you really want to embrace nature, then drink camel milk because it will cure all ills. And 5,000 camels. There had been camels in this country in the past, not so much, but 5,000 camels were imported into the United States, and now suddenly there are camels to contend with. And she petitioned the federal authorities, who had issued all of the milk regulations on a federal level, defining milk in terms of traditional categories, cow milk, goat milk, and convinced them to allow for the sale of camel milk in this country as well, so that the definition of milk in the federal pasteurized milk ordinance was expanded to go beyond the categories of cows and goats and to include other hooved animals. Other hooved animals mean any animal with hooves, and we know that camels have hooves, right? So they may not be, you know, split hooves, but the camels have hooves, and therefore the camels are considered to be permissible now, at least from a secular law perspective, for purposes of producing milk and selling the milk on the market. So we'll have to figure out how does that affect our ability to certify milk. If there hasn't been kosher supervision, does that mean that there's more of a fear nowadays that there will be a mixture of non-kosher milk together with the kosher milk? Not only that, but they've done other things with camel milk that nobody would have thought, based on reading the Gemara, that you could do anymore. One of the things that the Gemara discusses is also whether cheese has to be supervised by Jews, and we paskin that also Mishnah says Gevinas Yisrael, that you require milk, you require cheese to be supervised by Jews in order to be kosher. The Mishnah doesn't give an explicit reason. The Gemara gives six or seven different reasons. So we're worried you'll be mamid or kevas nevela, that you'll use as the rennet to turn milk into cheese. You'll use the skin of an animal that's not kosher in order to produce the cheese. So we require a Jew to participate in the cheese-making process. The Rama says, enough if a Jew watches, just like with milk. We generally are stringent like the Shach, who says that a Jew has to actually participate in putting the rennet into the milk in order to produce the cheese. But with respect to cheese, the Gemara says that, generally speaking, we wouldn't be worried that the milk that's used for cheese is milk from a non-kosher animal, because non-kosher milk does not congeal, does not coagulate to become cheese. To some of the bright people in the bioscience industry of today, figuring that there are all these wonderful health benefits with camel milk, why not turn it into camel cheese as well? So there's a bioscience engineering firm called CHR Kerr Hansen, which figured out how to coagulate camel milk and make it into cheese. So do we say that as a result, we have to revisit some of our considerations that the Rama says in Siman Kuf Tes Vav and Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya, that Miyakaradin, you don't have to worry with cheese. Of course, it requires Gvinas Yisrael supervision, that the Jew has to participate in the cheese-making process. But Miyakaradin, you don't have to worry about the milk being milk that was supervised that has to be Chalav Yisrael. We should be Machmir, the Rama says, but Miyakaradin, it's only a Chumrah. So maybe because it's only a Chumrah, because we know that if the milk was made into the cheese, so the source of the milk must be a kosher animal, because otherwise it wouldn't coagulate to become cheese altogether. So does that need to be revisited? And the other interesting development that has occurred in the last few years is that for a long time, and this is a part and parcel of the name of the milk ordinance on a federal level, it's called the pasteurized milk ordinance. So for a long time, all milk had to be pasteurized in order to be sold commercially in the United States, because it was felt that non-pasteurized milk was very unhealthy because of all of the bacteria. You know, you go to stores nowadays and they have the freshly squeezed juice, you know, you can get with a kosher symbol in many of the large stores we have in Chicago, the freshly squeezed orange juice, the freshly squeezed grapefruit juice, freshly squeezed lemonade, you know, whatever you want, and has nice, you know, hashkachos on it so that you know that it's kosher too, so everybody can enjoy it, but it has this warning label, which is, if you drink this, you may die, because this is not pasteurized, and because there might be all kinds of bacteria. It doesn't matter. We serve it in our Shabbos table on a regular basis, but the concern was that particularly with milk, there's all kinds of bacteria that are swarming around. And if it's not properly pasteurized, then it's going to be extremely unhealthy. So for a long time, people weren't drinking raw milk altogether. But now, in addition to there being a camel milk lobby, there's also a raw milk lobby. And the raw milk lobby is even fiercer and more passionate than the camel milk lobby. And they've been pushing for a recognition of raw milk, and for the allowance of raw milk to be sold commercially. So now I believe in 33 states, it might be more since I last read about it, they've passed legislation allowing for the sale of raw milk. For the most part, the raw milk is only allowed to be sold on the dairy farms as opposed to in the supermarkets. So you go to the supermarkets, you're not going to find raw milk. But the labeling requirements with respect to raw milk tend to be much less developed at this point in time than all of the labeling requirements that are outlined in the pasteurized milk ordinance on a federal level, because could be expected, the pasteurized milk ordinance only addresses what needs to be done with respect to pasteurized milk as opposed to the raw milk. So how did all of these different developments affect kosher certification? Now, if you look at the Gemara, this is I gave out some source sheets over here. In source, we've covered, I guess, source number one, essentially. We look in source number two. So source number two, base over here, says that there are different levels of supervision that are required based on whether a particular farm has a non-kosher animal in it or it doesn't have a non-kosher animal in it. So if there are non-kosher animals inside of the farm, so then it requires that the Jewish supervisor be able to see the milking process. Now, the Jewish supervisor could be male, female, adult, minor. The Jewish supervisor does not have to necessarily stand up and watch the entire milking process as long as the supervisor is capable of standing up and watching the process. So that's good enough. that's good enough. And the reason for that is because since there's a possibility that the Jewish person is going to stand up at any point in time from where they're sitting and watch the milking process, the Gentile farmer is going to be fearful of being caught and therefore is not going to mix the non-kosher milk together with the kosher milk. Now, of course, the post can point out this is only if the non-kosher farmer knows that they're not supposed to mix the non-kosher milk together with the milk, and that's why the Jewish supervisor is standing outside. But assuming that this is all understood, that's good enough. However, if there is no davar tamei be'edro, there is no non-kosher animal on the farm, so then it's not necessary even for the Jewish supervisor to be able to stand up and watch the milking process, as long as the Jewish supervisor is sitting outside and just kind of like watching the road. What's the value of the fact that there's a Jewish supervisor sitting, you know, outside, you know, the fence of the farm? So the value is that if anybody would come along, there would be a visitor and they would be, you know, bringing some buckets, you know, in with them. So the Jewish watch person would be able to see if there was non-kosher milk that was being brought inside of the plant. So therefore, it still is a level of a supervision. But we see that there are different levels of supervision. So do we say that, let's say there is a let's say that there is a place where there isn't even a concern that somebody's going to come with buckets of non-kosher milk or bring in a non-kosher animal from the outside because of the fact that there are no non-kosher animals at all in the entire region. So this was the situation that was addressed by the Pri Chadosh. So the Pri Chadosh lived a few hundred years ago. So the Pri Chadosh, it was I think he lived in Amsterdam for a period of time when he wrote his Perish, the Pri Chadosh. He was in his early 30s when he wrote the Pri Chadosh, not to, like, you know, discourage anybody here. But, you know, he died at a young age, but, you know, you think of, like, the great European Gaonim, so you think of, like, what do you think of? You think of a Gaon, you think of, like, you know, some rabbi with a long white beard or whatever. So, Pri Chadosh, I don't know. I don't think he was much more than in his late 30s or 40s, you know, when he passed away altogether. So he wrote the Pri Chadosh when he was in his early 30s. And he points out that where he lives in Amsterdam, the minhag is that everybody consumes what we would call chalav stam, regular milk that doesn't have a Jewish person supervising it. And he says that the reason is because there's no chash taruvis, because there are no non-kosher animals in the entire city. So he says, just as we see that there are diminished levels of supervision, that if there's no non-kosher animal in the farm, so then it's not necessary to be able to see the farming process, we lessen the level of supervision a little bit. So if there are no non-kosher animals in the entire region, where it's just a strong umdana, that for sure you know that no milk is going to no non-kosher milk is going to be mixed in, so then you don't even need a Jewish presence at all anywhere on the farm, so that there is no notion of lo plug, shall we say. He says, we see from the Gemara that only when there's a kshash taruvis, if you look at source hey, the habitaleka dava tami be'adroki tiwav shedavo eklal chalivalo omid velo yoshev. And therefore, he says that this can be distinguished from the case of Gevina Sakam. When it comes to Gevina Sakam, even if we know that Parif Rennet is being used, they're using rennet from flowers or something in order to be mami, the cholov, to become Gevina, nonetheless, we're not allowed to eat Gevina Sakam without Jewish supervision, because it's based on the Rambam, who quotes the Gaonim, who say that when it comes to Gevina Sakam, it became like a low plug, that this is something that was instituted by Chazal, even when the reasons are not applicable. And and this is explained by the Meforshei Rambam, that it's essentially a davar shebeminyan. It's essentially viewed as a davar shebeminyan, that it cannot be overridden in any way. But he says this is not treated like a gevina. If it were im ayudin chalav kegevina shanachri hayolano leso kochal shechal banachri ven yisoro eyu, that we wouldn't have been lenient even if there was no non-kosher animal on the farm to allow for a Jew just to sit inside who's not able to see the milking process. Rather, we see that it's more akin to the case of Mor Yoshel Nachman, which the Mishnah describes, that one of the things, because Chazal, what goes there that you couldn't eat, is the brine the fish brine that was made by the Nachman, because they would mix in Stam Yenim. They would mix in their wine, and you're not allowed to drink the Stam Yenim of a non-Jew. However, the Gemara says that if you live in a vicinity where the wine is very expensive, you don't have to worry that the Gentiles mixed in the wine to the brine in order to beef it up or anything, because it would be too expensive for them to do so. So then the Morius becomes permitted. So he says the same thing would be true with respect to the Cholov, that if you find the Cholov Tamei Enonim, says the end of the fourth line, Hachinamim Cholov Tamei Enonim. So there is no non-kosher milk in that vicinity, Mokam Echa. Oshinimso, or you do have non-kosher milk, Eloshiyote Biyokim Echolov Tar, which is just much more expensive than kosher milk, and that would often be the case, because from the non-kosher animals, it's generally, you know, much more difficult to milk them and to produce milk than it is with respect to the cows. So you can work, you have to work much harder to get milk out of a camel. And as a result, it's also much more expensive. I mean, here in this country, if you want to buy, now that camel milk has become permitted, if you want to go in, and not that I've done it, but if you want to go in and purchase camel milk, it costs something like $80 to $130 a gallon. So that's much, much more expensive than cow milk. So therefore, there would be no incentive for the non-Jewish farmers to mix the camel milk together with the cow milk, because that they'd be losing out from a much more valuable proposition if they did so. So therefore, ein lasso, in those types of cases, it says the Pichadosh, ein lasso sham, in those places, you should not prohibit the chalav shechavu nachvi v'ein yisroa v'o'eyu, elamuta leilech liknos menachim chalav shalahem. Rather, it's completely permissible, and shalom ha'yisroa. So the Pichadosh tried to do away with a chalav of Yisrael already hundreds of years ago. You see, it's not just kind of like a modern Orthodox thing. So this was already the shita that he described as being practiced, v'chein matzasi minik pashu po Amsterdam, as being practiced in Amsterdam a few hundred years ago. So the Aruch HaShulchan points out that for the most part, the poskim of Europe did not accept the leniency of the pre-Chodesh. This was really for two reasons. One was the reason of the Chassam Sofer, who says that only Gvinas Akum is a Davar Shebeminyan, just like Gvinas Akum is a Davar Shebeminyan, so too Cholav Akum is a Davar Shebeminyan. Once Chazal said that milk is prohibited unless a Jew directly is present during the milking process, whether they're sitting outside or sitting in a way in which they could stand up every so often, depending on the situation inside the farm, that became a low plug, and therefore milk is considered to be prohibited unless there is a Jewish supervisor on site, go set the watchman. However, that is not necessarily agreed upon by everybody, that we don't find early sources saying that Chalav of Yisrael is also a Davar Shebeminyan or a low plug. It's similar to Gvinas Yisrael. So the Chachmas Adam gives a different explanation. The Chachmas Adam says, look at the situation where there's Eino Davar Tamei Be'edro. There's no non-kosher animal inside of the flock. So Chazal could have said, if they were going to be lenient, they could have said, you don't need a supervisor altogether. But they said, even though it's only an infinitesimal concern, there may be some non-kosher milk or non-kosher animal is going to be brought into this farm that never had non-kosher milk ever on its vicinity. Nonetheless, Chazal required somebody to be present. So says the Chachmas Adam, we see from this that even if the concern is very, very tiny and infinitesimal, let's say there are no non-kosher animals in the entire vicinity, but maybe one will come to visit one day, or maybe somebody will transport some non-kosher milk one day, even though it's only a teeny tiny minute concern, nonetheless, what we see from Chazal, what we see from the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, is that we have to be worried even about the most minute concerns. So the Aruch HaShulchan kind of goes in this vein, and he says that one should not be mekel. Udalo ke'echa, you look in source vav. Udalo, this is the Aruch HaShulchan Siman Kuf Tesvav. Udalo ke'echa migedolei achronim sherech b'zeh, not like one of the gedolei achronim who shall remain unnamed. Sheherich Bezer, who went on about this and gave some sort of a leniency when there is no Davar Tamei in the vicinity, or because it's just not likely that they would mix the non-kosher milk because it's much more expensive, and therefore it says, there are many who are lax, unfortunately, when it comes to this prohibition in our generation and our multitude of sins. Kashirin Rishaman Alini tells a story about how when he served as a rabbi in an unnamed town earlier in his career, one of the Balabatim used to go on business trips, and he would always stop in a particular inn where there was a particularly good hot drink, like a cappuccino drink made partially out of milk, that he would have every single morning. And he said, wow, this is such a great coffee shop where I stop, and I have these great cappuccinos every single morning. And he would go with his business acquaintances, and he would stop there, and he didn't follow the CRC guidelines in terms of what you're allowed to have or not. And he wanted to find out what it was that made this hot milk drink so incredibly delicious. So one day, he went to Halachula Chenvani, it's about five lines down the second paragraph, Halachula Chenvani B'shalo, he asked the innkeeper, V'amleya Chenvani, and the innkeeper said, oh, ani kone be'ili shabasar ha'be mo'ach shela behemos. What I do is, I go to the meat market, and I buy a lot of brains from these trefa animals, V'macha osamim ha'be cholav, and I crush them together with the milk, V'vashlam b'yach, and I cook them all together, delicious cappuccino. V'zehu ha'shem nunis, and that's why it tastes so good. So everybody fell on their faces with a tremendous agony over their sin. They ate trafe, they ate basav chalav, all kinds of sins. This balabayas confessed in front of me, says the Aruch HaShulchan, it's sark recall, and he cried out with a great loud voice, how great are the words of our sages. So the Aruch HaShulchan kind of, you know, grinds in the point with a good anecdote. He says that the Gzeiros Chachamim, there might be specific reasons that are given, but you don't know all the reasons the Chazal had in mind. Then he has a good measure. Shemati America, and I heard, you know, in that place, the Treif of Medina, in America, I heard a lot of people drink the pig milk in America because they have lots of swine, lots of pigs in America. So the Pri Chadosh was generally not relied upon by most of the poskim in Europe. And the question became here in America, leaving aside the pig milk, the truth of the matter is that pigs don't really produce viable milk that can be consumed by humans, so that's not really our concern so much. But people were still drinking chalav stam, as in the mid-20th century, there wasn't an abundance of chalav Yisrael that was available. Somebody wrote a shaila to Rav Moshe Feinstein about it. So in a tshuva to Rav Moshe Feinstein, our famous tshuva, in 1954, this is Yerodeh, Chelak Alos Mem Zayin, so Rav Moshe says that he thinks it's a separate reason over and beyond the rationale of the Pri Chadosh to permit chalav stam in this country, and that's because there's governmental supervision. He says, if there's governmental supervision, what's the reason that we allowed, when there was not a non-kosher animal in the farm, we allowed a Jewish supervisor to sit outside and occasionally stand up, even though not standing up the entire time? Because even if they just have the capacity to stand up, that's considered, and watch what's going on, that's considered to be good enough, the Gemara said, because of mirsus, because the person who's doing the milking is going to be fearful that they're going to watch them at any time. So it says, Moshe, if you have governmental supervision, so you have an anansadi, it's considered as if there is an actual presence of direct supervision there because of the mirsus factor, because of the fact because he says that if the governmental supervisors would catch this person milking non-kosher animals, and including non-kosher milk, then yazgiwas ha'esek shalehem, they'll close down the entire plant. And therefore, of course, they're going to be fearful of mixing, and therefore, yesh tam gadol lahate apoloshita sapri chadosh. So therefore, you could be make on this basis, because it's considered as if we're all there, as if the whole country is there. The government represents all the people include Jews, where everybody is there. It's considered as if there is an agency of supervision on our part that is ensuring that there will not be non-kosher milk, because there's a mirsus, because what do we need to achieve? We need to achieve this fear factor that the non-Jewish farmer would be fearful of mixing in the non-kosher milk, and this fear factor is in existence, and therefore you could be make on this basis. He says at the end that nonetheless it's appropriate for Bali Nefesh to be machmir, Bali Nefesh should be stringent. He says he himself was stringent. Even in America, only to drink chalav Yisrael, milk that had been directly watched, the milking had been directly watched by a Jew. But nonetheless, he does not impose this chumrah upon others. There's anecdotal evidence that he didn't impose this chumrah even on his own family members. It was only Rav Moshe himself who followed this. And he said also in the yeshivas, it's appropriate to only serve chalav Yisrael so that the children will understand that there's such a concept, and that will enable them to stay far away from any transgression. But otherwise, he was extremely makel about this. And he has another tshuva, which is a little bit more complicated in Chelek Aleph Simen Mem Tes, in which he suggests that even though the supervision in those days didn't take place at the farms themselves, but only at the dairy plants, the requirement of Chazal for supervision is only Kishabal Yad Yisrael, when it's kind of at the point that it's about to be passed over to the Jewish consumer, and therefore it was sufficient that there was supervision at the dairy plant. But in any event, Ramoshe brought along this other consideration that because the government is so strict in requiring that all milk that is sold must be cow milk, and if a person would sell milk that would not be cow milk, that would be, for example, camel milk, then they would get into a heap of trouble. They would be fined. Their entire business could be closed down. So therefore, this consideration created effective supervision, as if there is a supervision on site, and a sufficient mirsas factor as a result, that it's akin to the Jewish supervisor who could stand up at any time, and therefore the Gentile farmer is afraid of mixing in non-kosher milk. So part of the question then becomes, so when you introduce the camel milk on the market, so what changes, or does anything change, and now that it no longer is prohibited to sell camel milk in this country, so does this heter of Cholov Stam of Moshe go away? And furthermore, Rav Moshe has an additional heter. This is in source number 11. Rav Moshe in Chelek Gimel Siman Tezayin says that the chumrah that I mentioned before of the Ramah. You remember we mentioned the chumrah of the Ramah. So we said that the stringency of the Ramah to require that when there's Gvinas Yisrael, when there's cheese making, that the cheese be made only from Chalav, which is Chalav Yisrael, which is really just a stringency because Chalav, milk of non-kosher animals, doesn't coagulate to become cheese. So Rav Moshe says, even though the Ramah is a machmir, but even for Baal Nefesh, he says, that would be a chumrah agavi chumrah. That for Baal Nefesh to say, okay, I'm not going to drink Chalav Yisrael, I'm not going to drink Chalav Stam, and I'll only drink Chalav Yisrael, so that's, you know, one appropriate thing for the Baal Nefesh to do. But for Baal Nefesh to say, not only, and when it comes to drinking milk, am I only going to drink Chalav Yisrael, but I'm going to insist that when I buy cheese, that the cheese be made only from milk that started as Chalav Yisrael, so he says, that's a chumrah, gabi chumrah, even a Baal Nefesh doesn't have to follow that chumrah. So does that have to be revisited now that there is the capacity for camel milk to be made into camel cheese, based on what Chazal did not seem to anticipate, but perhaps changes in technology that, based on these bioscience engineering firms, Kerr Hansen came along now. They just published an article on their site several months ago, that now they've not only figured out how to make cheese out of camel milk, but they figured out how to make cheese out of donkey milk too. So does this change the reality on the ground, even with respect to this kula that Rav Moshe fashioned, not only for your average non-Baal Nefesh layperson, but even for the Baal Nefesh when it comes to the purchase of cheese? Well, first of all, it's important to know that not everybody agreed with the kula of Rav Moshe altogether. You look at the Chelkas Binyamin, that's source 12. Chelkas Binyamin, of course, is a sefer written by Rav Binyamin Konis, the son of Rav Ivel Kohn from Brooklyn. He's written a number of excellent svarim on Machol Yakum, on Ribbis, on Skiris Paulim, a whole host of different things. So it's a very good svarim. So the Chelkas Binyamin, hearkening back to the Aruch HaShulchan's approach when he cited the Pre-Chadosh, cites an unnamed authority. Yesh min shekasa, there is somebody who wrote, da'afilu ema machlavi b'vishis akum, that even if the milking facility is in the possession or the oversight only of a non-Jew, mikom akum ema chalazim mishim chalav akum, mishim she bevada liyarvu bo chalav tomei machmas yirasum b'fakhei emem shalav, because they're going to be fearful of the governmental authorities. And therefore it's similar to the case that we mentioned where the Jew could stand up, and therefore that is considered to be sufficient supervision. But look in the fourth line of Al-Havi Poskim Nechlekolze, but he points out many Poskim disagreed with this Heter of Moshe. By the way, this Heter of Moshe was shared by Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish also said one could rely on governmental supervision, but he didn't consider it to be in a different category than the Pre-Chadosh. He considered it to be essentially an application of the Pre-Chadosh, that the Pre-Chadosh said, when there's no realistic possibility of there being a mixture of non-kosher milk, you could be maker. So he said, well, there's governmental supervision and penalty from the government, so then there's no realistic possibility. Rav Moshe also in his Tshuvos seems to incorporate a little bit of the svara of the Pre-Chadosh too, because he says, somebody asked him, oh, but why don't we have to be worried that the non-Jewish owner of the facility would just bribe the workers not to tell the governmental authorities what they're doing? So Moshe says, well, it costs so much, they have to bribe everybody because there are so many people involved in the production of the milk that it would be just too way big of an expense. And he quotes the Gemara that says, just like Chazal permitted buying the fish brine, even though normally wine would get mixed in if it was a vicinity where the wine would cost a lot of money. So he also uses some of the similar rationales to the Pre-Chadosh. But he says that many poskim say that just like we're not the poskim, most poskim roundly rejected the Pre-Chadosh's heter, we should reject this one too. In Eretz Yisrael, they don't rely upon this heter. Why don't they rely upon an Eretz Yisrael? So I'm told that there are two reasons. Number one, there's so much Chalav Yisrael, so why do you need to come to this kula altogether? It's why Rabbi Belsky's Zatzal was quoted as saying that he didn't think Rav Moshe would give the same heter nowadays when Chalav Yisrael is so much more widely available. It even tastes better than it used to, and it even lasts longer than it used to. At least in Chicago, it tastes pretty good. So therefore, he didn't think that Rav Moshe would be mekel. But Rav Moshe himself said that even a Baal Nefesh only has to be machmir if it's not a higher price and an inferior quality. But otherwise, even a Baal Nefesh shouldn't have to be machmir. So it's mashmir from a Moshe that even in those circumstances, he didn't require a non-Baal Nefesh to be machmir. But there is an unpublished tshuva in which he seemed to suggest as much, and that's what's quoted here by the Chilkas Binyamin. He quotes a tshuva acheres of a Moshe in the Sefer Pesachei Halacha that he wrote, "Remarkum she'ef shel ha'sikol shetachas shkachas yisav she'olav b'tzas tiocha yotiv." Even if it's a little bit more tiocha, "Vapiyokim at emin aroy la'arku b'zeh u'tzrichim la'hasigo," and it sounds, "M'stimas adram nira muchat b'la b'balei nefesh davka mishtoy." He wasn't only talking about Baal Nefesh, but Rav Moshe in the published tshuvos, in the tshuva which is in Chelek Gimel Siman Tes Zayin, seems to indicate that even with the Baal Nefesh, he says that his chumra is only lebali nefesh, but makom she'ef shel hasig below tiocha below chiluk be'ashiva kedibiarti, and he's only machmir for the bali nefesh, the last three lines of source yud aleph, only if it's below tiocha. So it sounds like if it's not a bali nefesh, even if it was below tiocha below chiluk be'ashiva, you could there's no price differential, you could be mekel. So I don't know, maybe it's a stira different zakim of Rav Moshe. But anyway, so the kula of Rav Moshe, what if one is going to be summoned upon it? So the question becomes, how does that change? How does it become revisited given the realities of the current market? So one good piece of news is that the Pre-Chadosh becomes much more viable. Why is that? Because the base mayor, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Tes Vav, that's source number 7, says, when is it that the Pre-Chadosh was mekel? The Pre-Chadosh was only mekel if the non-kosher milk would have a market, because then in such a case, if the non-kosher milk was much more expensive, so the farmer would be able to sell the non-kosher milk. But if there was no market for selling the non-kosher milk, because they wouldn't allow the non-kosher milk to be sold, so then a farmer who's stuck with some non-kosher milk would have no choice but to mix it up together with the kosher milk, because there would be no market for it, even if it's much more valuable. So based on the comments of the base mayor, because the base mayor says, in our Medina, the people don't buy non-kosher milk, so therefore you can't rely upon the Pre-Chadosh. So now that the if one would have been worried about camel milk because of the fact that the camel milk now is permitted to be on the market, the very fact that people are going out there in the health food stores or whatever and then buying the camel milk, so that's good news for those who want to rely upon the Pre-Chadosh. It was based on the base mayor. Now the Pre-Chadosh has been resuscitated because since there's a market for it, so therefore there's much less of an incentive to mix together the $80 to $130 a gallon camel milk with the $5 a gallon cow milk and to sell it together. So the umdun of the Pre-Chadosh would be more applicable than ever. However, what about Rav Moshe? Now that the definition of milk has been expanded to include camel milk, so do we have to just insist, whether you hold like Rabbi Belsky or not, that Rav Moshe himself would no longer apply his heter in this day and age? Let's say you assume, like most kashrus companies, that we still give hashkocha on Chol of Stam, that Rav Moshe would still apply his heter in this day and age. Some say that Me'ikar Adin, we even can be somech on the Pre-Chadosh. But if one was relying not on the Pri Chodesh, because that seems to be more suspect, but one is relying upon Rav Moshe's Heter, so would that have to be revisited? So what comes to the rescue here is the federal labeling statutes, because the federal labeling statutes say very, very clearly that if you do sell milk, which is not cow milk, forget about camel milk, even if it's some other type of milk, it's not cow milk, then it has to be very conspicuously, identified as such. So if you look on page 6 of the materials, it says very clearly that all bottles, it's not written in actual English, but nonetheless you could figure out what they meant to say. It says all bottles, containers, and packages containing milk or milk products, except milk tank trucks, storage tanks, and cans of raw milk from individual dairy farms. Again, we have the exclusion for the dam with raw milk we'll talk about, shall be conspicuously marked with the common name of the hoofed mammal producing the milk shall proceed. Again, that's where the English problem comes in over here. But okay, so whatever the run-out nature of the sentence, it makes it very clear that the common name of the hoofed mammal, such as a camel, for example, has to precede the name of the milk or milk product when the product is or is made from other than cattle's milk. Now, one concern when reading the statute that a number of people had is, well, maybe the statute only applies if you're selling camel milk alone. As opposed to if you're selling a cow milk product that just happens to have a little bit of camel milk, which is mixed in, which is, of course, the very case that Chazal were worried about in the first place. They weren't worried about when camel milk is sold alone because it has a different color than regular cow milk, according to the Gemara. So does the statute really cover that situation? So here we have to just rely upon the knowledge which is out there by people in the field. I've been reassured by Department of Health officials in Illinois that, of course, even if there was the tiniest amount of non-cow milk that was mixed in, it would be subject to this regulation. The regulation requires if the bottle container contains any milk product, which means any amount of a milk product which is non-cow milk, that it would have to be conspicuously labeled. So if there was any amount of camel milk, that would have to be conspicuously labeled. Rabbi Avram Gordimer, who we all know, who works from our yeshiva, who works for the OU, has confirmed the same to me in his conversations with federal officials, and also has confirmed that milk is perhaps the most regular, certainly one of the most, if not the most, regulated food item in the entire country, and therefore there really continues to be a tremendous mirsos, a tremendous fear of anyone who would be caught and not abiding with this federal regulation, that the milk products have to, if they include non-cow milk, if they include camel milk, they would have to be very conspicuously labeled. So how do they label the cow milk which is sold in the stores? When the cow milk is sold in the stores, I had somebody go in and take a look, because in my standard supermarket, they don't sell camel milk. You have to go to the specialized health food stores. It's interesting because they don't necessarily actually have the word camel on it. They just have a large picture of a camel. So it's understood that when you buy this milk, so there'll be a large picture of the camel. So if it doesn't say camel, or there isn't a large picture, if you buy a milk container now and it has a picture of a camel, so you have to worry. But if it doesn't say camel milk, or it doesn't have a picture of a camel, so then you would still be okay. But what happened? I'm sorry?
They don't have to label it with words. Ingredients camel milk?
They would. If it's, in other words, if, what did I say? Okay, let me say it again. So if it says, so if it doesn't say camel milk, it doesn't have a picture of a camel, you don't have to worry, because they have an obligation in the event that there would be any camel milk in the milk product, there would be an obligation for the manufacturer to label very, very clearly and conspicuously that there is camel milk here. And if it doesn't say that there is camel milk, so then that means that there is no camel milk, because the labeling requirement on a federal level still requires that if there would be any camel milk, that it would be conspicuously labeled as such. Same thing with pigs.
The picture alone is not good.
I would think the picture alone shouldn't be good, but they seem to be allowing the picture alone. So that's why I'm telling you that you have to be worried if there's even a picture of a camel. So some seem to be interpreting the statute to mean that it could either say camel or have a large picture of the camel, that, you know, one picture is worth a thousand words, that would have the same effect as actually saying that it is a camel milk. So what happened in Illinois, and this is something which was followed in other places too, they wrote a Mishpacha magazine article about it, it was very interesting, is that our kashrus administrator for the COC, Rabbi Fishbein, in his research discovered that the Illinois statute had expanded on a statewide level the definition of milk. Not every single state has to allow for milk to be sold in its state to include camel milk. But Illinois wanted to follow what the rest of the country was doing in the federal statute, so it decided it would expand this definition of milk. And the main reason is because if there would be camel milk sold, they wanted to make sure that it would be subject to all of the same pasteurizing requirements and all of the other health inspection requirements that are included in its internal milk statute. But they did not incorporate the labeling requirements. So even though it was there on a federal level, we're worried that if the concern from the perspective of a Moshe is that there has to be a fear, a mirsa, so governmental regulation, that means that for the milk manufacturers, even on a state level, the statute has to make it abundantly clear that there is a problem. And since the state statute expanded the definition of milk to include hoofed animals, but didn't include the labeling requirements, therefore this was something that needed to be rectified. So they sent me down to the state capitol in Springfield, Illinois, to argue this case in front of the state senate over there. And we found one of our state senators, who's a mispalo who davens in the Orthodox community, is a member of the Orthodox community, Ira Silverstein, agreed to sponsor the bill. And what we tried to do was to just say, do you really need to have camel milk in Illinois? And to go back to the original statute that just said that milk shall mean the milk that comes out of cows and goats. Goats are fine, also a kosher animal. We even would have been okay with water buffalo, you know, which was also part of the expanded statute. Water buffalo is a mistama kosher animal. However, there was a pushback on the part of the Department of Health officials, because the Department of Health officials insisted that they were worried about there being contamination if there would be camel milk that was sold, because it could be sold on a federal level. And therefore, their main concern was to ensure that any camel milk that might cross state lines or anything of that sort would be subject to all of the rigorous health safety regulations, and therefore they couldn't take camels out of the expanded definition of a milk. So then I said, okay, well, if that's the case, so then the next best thing is that we need to incorporate the federal labeling requirements into the state statute. So I wrote that my proposed, if you look on page 5 over here, that the proposed amendment that I drafted on the spot, the amendment they gave me like a little, it was hard to find like pencils in the entire place, but they finally found a pencil and I scribbled it down on some piece of paper, was provided that there is a compliance with the labeling requirements set forth in the Grade A Pasteurized Milk Ordinance, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So they then changed that, and they took out the word compliance. They just said provided that it is labeled in accordance with. So I said, I don't like provided that it is labeled in accordance with, because from a Jewish law perspective, we need to strike fear. And that means that you have to enunciate very clearly there's a requirement here. Okay, that's why I said there has to be compliance, that if you don't do this, then that would constitute non-compliance. So therefore, I tweaked it again, and I said, and I added the words, must be. I said, provided that it must be labeled in accordance with. So they were okay with that. Must be didn't, you know, change the meaning of the sentence. They were okay with must be. So in the end, that was the statute that passed. It was passed last August. It finally made its way to the governor. Nice, you know, photo op for the president of the CRC. I wasn't at the picture-taking ceremony. It was signed into law. So we at least felt that we were able to address it from a Moshe perspective. However, the raw milk lobbyists were relentless, because originally the statute did not provide any kind of exception for raw milk. And since I said in the definition of milk that it has to be labeled in accordance with labeling requirements, the raw milk lobby said, but we're not subject to labeling requirements and we don't want to be subject to labeling requirements. So we tried to push back with respect to the raw milk lobby, but as I said, they were very, very persistent. And in the end, the raw milk lobby got their way, because there might be some future federal statute that's going to deal with labeling requirements with respect to raw milk, and they told me that that is in the works, but as it stands right now, there is no labeling requirement. So the good news is that the raw milk can only be sold on the dairy farm. So you still don't have to be worried from a Moshe perspective with respect to anything which is sold in the supermarkets, but you do have to be worried with respect to the dairy farms. I was in Silver Spring a little while ago, and there was a fellow who came up to me who was, you know, like a raw milk advocate himself, you know, because seeing the health benefits, I suppose, of drinking milk in its original pristine state. And he told me that he would go to a local farm, which was in the area, where there were no non-kosher animals on the farm. It was just purely cows or whatever. But, you know, he figured that be nothing wrong because of Moshe, that he'll go, and he'll just drink the raw milk that they sell him. and he's been drinking the raw milk. Is that a problem? So I said, of course it's a problem, because now it's perfectly permissible to sell raw milk, and it's perfectly permissible to sell raw milk on the farms without any kind of labeling requirement whatsoever. So therefore, you have nothing to rely upon. You don't have, you might have a pre-chadosh if you say that this is a farm where there are no non-kosher, you know, animals in the vicinity, but even that's not so clear, because in this day and age of commerce, yeah, it's much easier to transport non-kosher milk to various facilities than ever before. You might say, well, it still wouldn't be worth it for them to mix the camel milk with the cow milk because they can get a much bigger price, so maybe still the pre-chadosh to rely upon, but you certainly don't have Rav Moshe to rely upon in that circumstance, and therefore I told him he should no longer go to the farm unless he's going to actually be there present during the milking of the cows, and then he can drink the raw milk if he's crazy enough to do so. However, otherwise, this is something which can't be done. So there are real practical ramifications on a real life basis with respect to some of the changes on the ground. What about with respect to the cheese curdling consideration? With respect to the fact that now there are tests that indicate that camel milk can really coagulate. That camel milk can coagulate to become cheese. So the truth of the matter is that here as well, you have to, you know, look at the fine print a little bit more. What exactly does that mean, that the camel milk can be coagulated to create cheese? So it doesn't mean any kind of cheese. For the most part, the cheese that they're talking about is a type of soft cheese or semi-soft cheese, but not the hard cheeses. You may recall from Rav Moshe's other tshuvos, that I don't recall from anything I mentioned this year, but Rav Moshe says elsewhere that he doesn't think that the whole gzeira of Gevina Sa'akum applies altogether to soft cheese, or at least one can make a strong argument. It doesn't come out definitively. Does it apply to soft cheese? Because soft cheese can be created without adding rennet in the first place, so therefore he didn't think the gzeira chazal applied to soft cheese. So he doesn't really, when he speaks about how you don't have to be machmir, have the two chumras, he's really not focusing on soft cheese altogether. He's focusing mostly on hard cheese, because Rav Moshe viewed soft cheese in a totally different category. Secondly, the Radbaz understood the Chazal statement that the non-kosher milk cannot be turned into cheese was really only a reference to hard cheese in the first place and not to soft cheese. That is perfectly possible, said the Radbaz, that it could actually turn into soft cheese. So this is not necessarily, first of all, a change in the metzias in the ground. It could be Chazal were perfectly aware of this, and therefore would not change the reality with respect to hard cheese. It certainly would indicate that when you're dealing with the type of challah that's going to be used to make soft cheese, that there would be more reason to be circumspect. However, with respect to the hard cheese, it certainly would not necessarily change the reality on the ground. And the Ritva, in his commentary to Masechta Avodah Zarah, also says that when Chazal said that the non-kosher milk cannot be used to make cheese, it doesn't mean that none of the milk will turn into cheese. It just means the vast majority will not turn into cheese. So even with respect to the efforts that are being made now to turn camel milk into cheese, it's still a very, very arduous process, and it doesn't necessarily change the essential chazaka that Chazal were working with. And fourthly, in order to turn the camel milk into the cheese, they have to use very, very special enzymes. They can't use the regular enzymes, and therefore, unless one knows that special enzymes were made in the production of cheese, one presumably can work with the assumption that the standard enzymes that we use for the production of cheese in general were used to produce the cheese that is in front of you. So it would seem that despite the developments and the new technology that has been developed to more capably and effectively turn camel milk into cheese, that probably would not impinge upon the heter that Rav Moshe was writing, at least with respect to the purchase of hard cheese, where Rav Moshe was saying that it's not necessary even for a Baal Nefesh to have this double chumrah of, number one, not drinking chalav stam, and number two, ensuring that any gavina which is produced also come from chalav Yisrael. It doesn't mean that everyone is comfortable with that kula of Rav Moshe, but to the extent that somebody has been somech on Rav Moshe's requirements for a Baal Nefesh, so presumably that kula would still remain in place, assuming that Rav Moshe's kula in general with respect to Chalav Stam would still remain in place. However, as I mentioned earlier, there are certainly poskim who don't rely upon Rav Moshe, What we're discussing is to the degree in which one is lenient nowadays, or with respect to cholostam, to what degree one has to revisit the nature of their leniency. Is there any other ramification that comes out of all of this? Bein l'chumra, bein l'kula. So there's one other nice kula that emerges that is courtesy of the raw milk lobby. So what good did the raw milk lobby do for us? Now they're selling camel milk and they don't even have to be labeled, and you have these people who are coming onto the farms thinking that everything is hunky-dory and they could drink the raw milk, but in fact they can't drink it without directly supervising the milking process. So what good could come out of what the raw milk lobby is doing out there? So the one good thing is really a comment which is in the Minchas Yitzchak. The Minchas Yitzchak in Chelek Yud Siman Samach Zayin talks about another problem with milk. And this is a problem that most of us probably wouldn't even think about at all, because we've become so accustomed to drinking milk. And that is the pasteurization process. When you pasteurize a milk, you're essentially cooking it. You're heating it up. You're heating it up to high temperatures. That's cooking. There's another isser called bishul akum, that you can't drink that which food, which you can't consume food that which was cooked by a non-Jew. Bishul akum, worry about iskatnus. So isn't that a problem of bishul akum? So you'll say, I wouldn't mean a problem bishul akum. You can drink milk raw, is what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, beferish. No problem of bishul akum when it comes to milk, because you could drink it raw. And many rely upon that Rambam. However, the problem is, says the Minchas Yitzchak, that all worked during the day and age in which people were consuming raw milk. But now that it's generally viewed as dangerous to consume raw milk, so since the reality has changed on the ground and people don't consume raw milk anymore because they're worried about bacteria and so forth, therefore we have to be concerned nowadays about bishul akum considerations, because the heter that something is consumed raw and therefore bishul akum wouldn't apply is no longer necessarily applicable to milk. So he says, so what do we rely upon? So he says, we rely upon a combination of leniencies. Number one, the pasteurization process is not direct cooking, it's more like steaming. And steaming is a suffix as to whether steaming is like smoking, and it's not subject to bishul akum. Maybe it is subject to bishul akum, it's one suffix. And number two, there's the shita of the Maharitats, who says that whenever you cook something in an industrial setting where you don't really know who's preparing it for you and you're not likely to go and marry their daughters, so then you don't have to worry about bishul akum. Just like we say that with respect to pas akum. So, not in general, we don't rely solely upon the maritats, but if you have the consideration, the number one, it's steam to begin with, and number two, it's in an industrial factory setting, so then he says that there's room to be make obeto based on that combination of considerations. However, at the end of the day, since none of this is 100% mochwach, so he recommends, he was able to recommend, so he's writing this when he was in Eretz Yisrael, he was the dayan for Badatz in Yerushalayim, so Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss, so he was able to recommend the stringency that people should really do their best to only purchase milk where a Jew participated in the pasteurization process. We don't really have that luxury here in the United States to only consume milk where a Jew participated in the pasteurization process, so you'd have to be worried about drinking milk in general if you'd be concerned about the stringency of the Minchas Yitzchak. But comes the raw milk lobby to the rescue, because now they have made it perfectly fashionable once again to consume raw milk in this country, where there's enough people who are doing it, and also the very mere fact that it's on the books. The Ritva in Avodah Zarah Daf Lamed Ches said that if a food is capable of raw assumption, and it's been defined by society as something which is capable of raw consumption, so even if it isn't consumed by the roe, by the majority of the people, that would be considered good enough to be labeled as nechal chai, as something which is consumed when it is raw, so that therefore it would be not subject to the proscription against bishul akum. So that's one, you know, positive development with respect to the changes that have been made from the standpoint of the raw milk lobby. So we see that there are really, you know, four different ramifications that needed to be researched and addressed in connection with the introduction of camel milk into the United States market. Number one, does the leniency of Rav Moshe still apply? And the answer is it does still apply because of labeling requirements, but on a state-to-state level, it's important to keep track of the legislation to make sure that the legislative changes that are made with respect to expanding the definition of milk are similarly made with respect to broadcasting the labeling requirements to all of the farmers and to the milk plant manufacturers. Number two, to the extent that there is a consideration of the pre-chadash out there, the fact that the camel milk is actually being marketed and sold, it makes the pre-chadash more viable for those who would take that into consideration. Third, that there have been changes now that it appears that there is more of a possibility, perhaps, that in the past to coagulate a camel milk and to make it into cheese, and therefore we revisited whether Ramosha's heter, even for Bali Nefesh, to purchase cheese that is, does not come from a Chalav Yisrael, needs to be modified, and we gave all kinds of reasons why that heter, at least with respect to hard cheese, should still remain in place. And fourth, from the perspective of the raw milk lobby and the fact that raw milk is now permissible to be sold in a number of different states, at least on the dairy farms, we realized that from the perspective of a Moshe's heter, somebody who was buying milk on a dairy farm, even if they're buying cow milk on a dairy farm, can no longer do that because of the fear that they might be consuming camel milk, which is not subject to labeling requirements, at least when it's sold on the farm. And number two, that there is one positive development that comes out of the fact that raw milk can now legally be sold in many states, insofar as it's much easier to now label that as something which is nechokai, so that one doesn't have to worry about the bishul akum considerations that were raised by the Minchas Yitzchak with respect to the pasteurization of milk. But what we see, yes. Certainly, oil shulchan malachim. Milk? Oh, are you talking about? Every milk drinks milk. They drink milk at a state dinner, they'll drink milk.
That was his broad definition of oil shulchan malachim. But the assumption is that not something that a melach would happen of itself, but if you give that a royal.
No, but again, something is not subject to bishul akum if either of the two considerations applies. Either it's not oil shulchan malachim, which is not the case over here, or it's nechokai. Let's say something is oil shulchan malachim, but it's also nechokai, so then it's not subject to bishul akum. Okay, so that's what we would be able to rely upon over here. If milk is nechokai, it doesn't matter that it's olal shulchan malachim, it still would not be subject to bishul.
I don't understand why milk is olal shulchan malachim.
Milk is definitely olal shulchan malachim.
What is Rabbi's definition of olal shulchan malachim?
Something you would serve at a state dinner?
They have milk at a fancy milk, go to a wedding, they'll give you a cup of milk.
Well, if it was a fancy state dinner by, like, you know, kings and queens, you know, of they would have milk. If you had a fancy dairy dinner, even, you know, so you would have milk. I think milk is olal shulchan malachim. I think so. Okay. And let's say you go to a simcha, which is a dairy simcha. So you would serve milk, even if you needed to be a kosher melech. Even Shlomo HaMelech, if he served a fancy dinner on Shavuos, so he would serve
milk. Milk in and of itself would not be served as. Meaning there could be products with dairy in it, but the milk in and of itself would not.
I think milk is olal shulchan malachim. Okay, certainly products with milk. I think so. Okay, so all right. So anyway, so this is why we always need the constant vigilance of our kashrus organizations and our poskim. Okay, we'll stop here.
No eating of fiddle, as far as the milk is concerned. It's a little bit captured. It's a question of.